Hi everyone, good evening. Welcome to the Middle East Centre and to the sixth iteration of our lecture series, Understanding and Analysing Iraq After the Disastrous 2003 Invasion and Occupation. I am absolutely delighted to be able to introduce my friend and former colleague, Wilfred Broad-Heckhammer. Wilfred is a professor of political science at the University of Oslo, and tonight we're going to hear the first slice of a really exciting book project, which is finished, which I understand is going to be hopefully coming out soon, looking at the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, and in particular, looking at a puzzle that suddenly I, of a generation of people who was politicized by the invasion, have thought about for a long time, which is why doesn't Saddam come clean when the writing is on the wall that the invasion is going to occur? So Wilfred is really the best placed person to speak to this issue. She's one of the leading experts on weapons of mass destruction, international security in the world. She's previously author of Unclear Physics, published by Cornell University Press. She's published in basically every major international security, international relations journal. I think today we're going to get a paper that was just published in International Security, really the premium outlet for this kind of work, called The Cheater's Dilemma, Iraq, WMD, and the 2003 War. I hope you can all join me in welcoming Wilfred for what is, I'm sure, going to be a really exciting talk. Thanks, Wilfred.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. It's wonderful to see a former colleague and to meet many new friends. So thank you so much for having me. So this project is part of really my main project as an academic, I think. When I was doing my master's thesis at the LSE, the Iraq invasion was about to happen, and somewhat like you, it has stayed with me, both as a theme that merits research, and also as an area where exciting new sources have kept emerging in the past two decades. So this is very, very much a moment where I'm excited to talk about some of my findings, some of my conclusions, and to discuss those with all of you. So I'm very happy to be here this evening. So as those of you who were around in 2003 may recall, the case for the invasion, the infamous slam dunk case, was based on Iraq having or actively pursuing weapons of mass destruction, WMD for short, and that was taken as the safe bet in making the case for a war. After the invasion, however, there were no such weapons, and that actually genuinely shocked many of the soldiers and inspectors that went to Iraq after 2003, and it raised a big puzzle. What had happened? In the words of one of the senior inspectors, David Kay, "We were all wrong," is what he told the US Congress. It's important to stress that it wasn't just the states that wanted to go to war against Iraq who believed there might be weapons or programs to produce weapons of mass destruction. This was a belief that was held by other countries in Europe and also in the Middle East. And it was a belief that had set in during the 1990s when there were UN weapons inspections taking place to ensure that Iraq disarmed of these weapons, as it was ordered to do by the UN Resolution 687, which ended the 1991 Gulf War. Iraq's behavior during the 1990s, its apparent resistance to these inspections, its reluctance, dragging of feet constantly, reinforced a view very early on that Iraq's basic modus operandi was to cheat and retreat. And this view became entrenched as early as late 1991, I have found, amongst the inspectors and the key countries on the UN Security Council. And there wasn't really anything Iraq could do that could convince countries otherwise. So the story really begins in April 1991 with Resolution 687, a ceasefire resolution ending the 1991 Gulf War. This resolution is sometimes called the mother of all resolutions. It's large, it contains many, many different aspects, but at the core of the resolution is the demand that Iraq verifiably and completely disarms of weapons of mass destruction. K completely and verifiably are key terms here. Completely is difficult to define in practice. In many ways, this ceasefire resolution can be compared to the Versailles Treaty, obliging Germany to disarm after the First World War. And it treats Iraq effectively as a defeated state, even though it's a ceasefire resolution. According to Ambassador Tom Pickering, who was the US ambassador at the Security Council overseeing the drafting of this resolution, it treated Iraq as a defeated state with no sovereign rights of resistance, meaning that the inspectors had the right to go everywhere and look at everything. Naturally, the Iraqi authorities did not like this. They were concerned that amongst the inspectors there might be others, or there might be opportunities for intelligence services to wiretap and piggyback off of these systems that were established in Iraq. So they were constantly pushing back against this expansive rights of access. At the same time, in 1991, Iraq was in terrible shape after the war. It was clear to senior Iraqi officials that the extensive sanctions that were imposed when Iraq had invaded Kuwait in 1990 posed a threat to regime survival. Senior officials such as Tariq Aziz, often foreign minister, sometimes deputy prime minister, told his senior colleagues in late 1991, Iraq is collapsing. The legal institutions, the police, everything is eroding. If you have any ideas how we can get rid of these sanctions, please let me know, because in reality, Iraq is failing, as he put it. So getting rid of the sanctions was essential. And this resolution provided an avenue for this by setting out a path whereby if Iraq completely and verifiably disarmed of these weapons, the Security Council could lift the sanctions. That sounds like a straightforward arrangement. Of course it wasn't. The resolution was designed in such a way that there was no automatic link but between Iraq's compliance, its disarmament, along with other areas that the resolution identified, and lifting these sanctions. And so it meant that the Security Council, where many of the states that had gone to war against Iraq in 1991, would decide whether Iraq had sufficiently complied and sanctions could be lifted. So this posed a difficult situation, of course, for Iraq in deciding how much to cooperate and how much to comply. To what extent would it hand over weapons and capabilities that, according to the experiences and perspectives of senior Iraqi officials, had played a crucial role in the war between Iran and Iraq. Chemical weapons were used on a large scale, and according to the Iraqi officials, had been essential for their survival. So to hand over these weapons completely and verifiably and submit to monitoring of this was a real security challenge for Iraq. And if there was no guarantee of sanctions being lifted in return, you had a real dilemma. And this frames the dilemma that I call the cheetah dilemma, which resulted from Iraq's initial stumbling, one could say, in tackling this situation. So hopefully you can see here, underlined in red, what Saddam Hussein himself said after he was captured in late 2003, when he was repeatedly debriefed, as the Americans put it, about a number of things, but most notably his weapons of mass destruction and why there weren't any to be found. So Saddam Hussein insisted to his increasingly frustrated American counterpart debriefer that there were no such weapons left, and that Iraq had already said this in the 1990s and provided documentation, but that no one had believed them. But here, Saddam is for once acknowledging a mistake. That didn't happen very often. Here he acknowledges that Iraq made a mistake by destroying some weapons, and here he's talking about chemical weapons and biological weapons, without UN supervision. when questioned as to whether Iraq also made a mistake regarding failure to provide complete disclosure initially and throughout the inspection process, Hussein responded, "That's a very good question." I also think that's a very, very good question. And Saddam Hussein never answered it. He only said it was a good question. So it has been my task to try and provide some answers based on the sources that have become available since the 2003 invasion. And the good news, I suppose, is that there is a lot to work with. There is really an enormous amount of source material coming from different sources. One is the captured records that are now somewhere in limbo in the United States system, but hopefully will emerge, that I have was able to consult before the center holding them shut down. But the other sources that I have collected include the personal archives of many senior Iraqi scientists and officials who were involved in the UN disarmament inspection process, and also their UN counterparts. So through these sources, I have been able to really look behind the scenes at discussions between senior Iraqi officials regarding how much to disclose in terms of information about their weapons, how much to cooperate with UN inspectors when they were really not sure whether cooperation would be rewarded or not, and to get a sense of how this played out in during the implementation process at various levels of this vast state apparatus. And what has emerged quite clearly from these sources is that there were really two important dynamics going on that I think were not sufficiently understood, certainly not prior to 2003. The first is what I've called a cheetah's dilemma, which is how much to reveal in terms of costly information, self-incriminating information in this case, such as development, testing, and use of chemical and biological weapons on political prisoners, acts of genocide, and so on and so forth, when the reward continues to be elusive, when the sanctions aren't lifted, even though you keep scaling up your disclosures. On the other hand, if you don't cooperate, you're likely to experience severe punishment, possibly even war. So this dilemma, I find, is central in the discussions between Iraqi regime officials throughout this process, and especially at key turning points in 2002 and 2003. The other dynamic that I think surprised me, at least, and was likely a surprise to many observers who were looking at Iraq prior to 2003, was how severe the implementation problems were. So when Saddam Hussein and his senior officials decided to scale up cooperation, to give the UN inspectors everything they asked for, which ultimately they did, their staff wouldn't do it. And so there are examples in the sources of Saddam's senior ministers spending hours in their bureaucracies pleading with people, saying, "Yes, we actually want you to cooperate. This is a genuine order. Please do it. If not, there will be war." Regardless of such pleading, we find numerous examples of orders not being followed, and even worse, perhaps, of individuals hiding valuable documents, designs of centrifuges and things like that, that were precisely what the inspectors were looking for, and that they were hiding them even in their own gardens in some cases, for personal profit motives, in some cases waiting for the regime change they thought was increasingly likely. So there are all kinds of problems that really sort of cut against this this narrative of Iraq as an authoritarian state that was ruled by Saddam personally. And so what I find is there was a lot that didn't work the way Saddam wanted to, and in fact one of his key problems was not only that the subordinates didn't do what they were told, but that his senior officials didn't even believe him when he said, "We have no weapons of mass destruction." So there's a lot going on in these sources. And I'm happy to talk about some of these things in my remarks today. And I'll share some examples of these sources as well. Hopefully you'll be as excited about them as I am. So starting in the beginning, after the 1991 Gulf War, it's perhaps difficult to imagine just how extensive the damage was and how difficult it was, both for Iraqi officials to begin to respond to this ceasefire resolution, which demanded that they admit inspectors within a few weeks, and for the inspectors once they arrived, how difficult and dangerous the conditions were on the ground. So in the first few weeks, there were a lot of strategic deliberations going on at the senior levels of the Iraqi regime regarding how much information should they provide the UN inspectors with in their initial declarations, their written statements about what they had, what kinds of weapons, what kinds of facilities, and also how welcoming should they be in terms of granting the inspectors access on the ground. And one of the key architects of Iraq's initial response to this ceasefire resolution was Hussein Kamel, one of Saddam's son-in-laws, who I think we can say was a son-in-law from hell, because he really, really created a lot of problems throughout this entire saga. But he was very, very powerful, and he was seen as someone who was, of course, not equal to Saddam in the regime, but he was certainly above many of the other senior ministers and was able to largely do whatever he wanted because everyone assumed Saddam Hussein backed whatever he said he would do. So Hussein Kamel was sitting down with the senior WMD scientists crafting a response to the 687 resolution. The scientists recommended just coming clean immediately. They thought the UN inspectors will have unimpeded access. We can't hide these vast programs with thousands of employees and large infrastructure, most of which was clearly identifiable, at least when it came to the nuclear weapons program. So why not just come clean and be done with it? Hussein Kamel disagreed. He considered a range of options from full cooperation to no cooperation, but landed on an approach whereby the Iraqis would only disclose what they thought the outside world already knew when it came to their weapons of mass destruction programs, and not be very forthcoming in response to questions, just answer very narrowly and let the UN inspectors figure it out, essentially. So this approach meant that there was a lot that the outside world did not know about Iraq's WMD programs, certainly when it came to the biological weapons program and the nuclear weapons program. Because Iraq had used chemical weapons and missiles during the war against Iran, the outside world had a fairly updated view of those capabilities. It wasn't really feasible to hide too much of that. But Hussein Kamel ordered that all the traces of the programs that were lesser known should be hidden in the few weeks prior to the arrival of the UN inspectors. And this led to hectic activity on the ground. You can imagine the scale of this challenge within a very short time frame to find these alternative purposes for all these big facilities, find alternative explanations for all of these activities. And the Iraqi intelligence services were writing memos complaining about how difficult this was and how it wasn't really feasible to keep up this facade in the months ahead. But at this point, they imagined that the inspections would last months and not years. But even months was a big headache for the Iraqi intelligence agencies to figure out alternative stories for these capabilities. So even as the UN inspectors were arriving, Iraqi intelligence agencies were organizing this cover-up effectively and did the best they could. But in some cases, when the inspectors started arriving at certain sites, they were trucking out documents through the back door, so it really was a last-minute operation, and unsurprisingly, the inspectors caught on to to it very quickly. So I mentioned David Kaye, and here you can see him wearing a light blue cap and sunglasses. He was one of the first inspectors to arrive in Iraq in the late spring of 1991. And what he found was the most blatant cover-up operation that you could possibly imagine. So in a series of inspections, he and his team uncovered a convoy of 85 trucks loaded with large pieces of equipment that could only be used for a nuclear weapons program. And they even took pictures of this convoy as it was making its way away from the particular base where he was conducting his inspection. So if there was ever a smoking gun, this is it. And there was absolutely no way that this could be explained away because the equipment photographed on these trucks had no other purpose than a nuclear weapons program. So this led to a lot of raised eyebrows, shall we say, in the Security Council, which immediately sent a delegation to Baghdad to ensure Iraq's cooperation in the future. And this is a memo, a handwritten memo from Hans Blix, who was at that point the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And these are his notes from meetings with senior Iraqi officials where they are demanding immediate access and unimpeded access for the inspectors. And Hans Blix was trying to give his Iraqi counterparts a way out by saying things like, perhaps you misinterpreted this resolution. Perhaps you interpreted the resolution differently from us and thought you didn't have to declare any nuclear equipment. But if you did, we can work this out and here's a way forward. And you know, the diplomatic suite thought that this would be a great way out of this very dicey situation with a lot of angry members on the Security Council calling for action to punish Iraq. He was disappointed to learn that the Iraqis weren't really interested in this kind of solution and that they just insisted that there was absolutely no nuclear weapons program in Iraq and they had no idea what he was talking about. So he left a few days later, very pessimistic and curious, as he reported back to the IAEA that he couldn't understand why Iraq would not just come clean, given this obvious evidence, and why they continued with this stonewalling. So here is an example of some of the items that the Iraqis were trucking away and hiding in the desert that the UN inspectors found shortly after. And this was a real coup for the inspectors because it was intractable evidence of a nuclear weapons program. And there was no, as I mentioned earlier, no other purpose for any of this equipment. The Iraqi response was still denial. And here's an example of one of the numerous statements that the Iraqi embassy in Vienna made, where they're starting to acknowledge, but not really saying that, well, maybe there were some activities going on, scientists do their own thing, but we had no idea, and it wasn't our fault anyway. So they were still trying to create a distance between the evidence of the nuclear weapons program and the political authorities because of their concern about what the consequences would be in terms of the sanctions, but also the prospect of military strikes against the regime. Eventually, though, within a few days, they relented and admitted that there had, in fact, been a nuclear weapons program. And this was the first of many such admissions where the inspectors found hard evidence. The Iraqis admitted to capabilities and activities across these WMD programs. And this very much reinforced this early impression that there was always this cheat and retreat pattern. So this is what a smoking gun looks like when it's recorded by the IAEA. So this is a detailed accounting of Iraq's many sins and failures of a mission. So it was something that pains the IAEA a great deal to acknowledge the scale of the Iraqi nuclear weapons program that had actually come quite close to a breakthrough and producing nuclear weapons at the time of the invasion of Kuwait. The IAEA, of course, was conducting inspections in Iraq precisely to provide assurance to other countries that there was no nuclear weapons program. Well, hey presto, there clearly was. And this led to an overhaul of the IAEA's inspection system, leading to the additional protocol that is now applied in very many countries that provides much more access to inspectors on the ground. So that's one of the sort of direct consequences of what transpired in Iraq. But this shocking discovery of a cover-up in action, where you know what was being covered up was a vast nuclear weapons program that had come much closer to success than most countries had suspected prior to this war, led to a number of conclusions in, amongst others, the CIA. And this is a part of a document from the CIA in October 1991 that I'd like you to have a look at. So this is based on the events of that summer and the cover-up of the nuclear weapons program. And the CIA states here that this pattern of non-compliance to UN Security Council resolutions almost certainly is driven more by a desire to preserve future options than it is by a fear of revealing past indiscretions. This judgment is quite sensible, but it is a judgment that becomes entrenched. It is a view that becomes entrenched and is not seriously revisited at any point afterwards. So what happens in the years between now fall 1991 and 1995 is that Iraq gradually eases up on its efforts to conceal information about its capabilities and past programs. But this judgment is not affected in any way by Iraq's increasing efforts to demonstrate compliance. And so this is, I think it's quite essential to show how early this view became entrenched. And the document continues to say that Iraq's continuing efforts to prevent the destruction or removal of its remaining nuclear infrastructure and our assessment of Saddam's tenacity in his desire for nuclear weapons lead us to conclude that Iraq intends to finish the weapons effort it started at least a decade ago. So continuing on the same theme, this view becomes entrenched not only in intelligence agencies, but also in several governments, including those on the Security Council. Over the next few years, however, Iraq tries to scale up its compliance, leading to a judgment in 1992 by the UN inspectors saying that at this point Iraq no longer poses a threat to the region in terms of its weapons of mass destruction. What is left is essentially accounting for how many weapons Iraq had, for all the materials that went into the past programs, and making sure that there's nothing hidden. But this is accounting, it's not a threat to international peace and security. So that view is communicated behind the scenes by the UN inspectors to Washington and to London, along with a suggestion that perhaps Iraq's behavior is driven by its concern to be seen as disarmed and weakened by its regional adversaries, notably Iran. And I think it's worth underlining that this explanation of Iraq's behavior came as early as 1992, when you know that this was absolutely also the conclusion of the post-2003 investigation into Iraq's missing weapons of mass destruction. So in a way, it's quite striking that all of those discoveries after the war led to the same belief. But of course, the people who made those judgments were also present in 1992. So again, bias is a big part of the story here, especially when dealing with a state that has been caught repeatedly in lies and deception. At this point, and we're still now in late 1991, Iraqi officials have a big problem. They have a big problem because they have a lot more hidden that the UN inspectors haven't found out about yet. Specifically, they have thousands of chemical weapons, and they also have some biological weapons that the outside world hasn't realized that Iraq can't produce yet. So what happens is a unilateral destruction, a secret operation to destroy these weapons rather than hand them over to the UN inspectors for verification purposes, as the ceasefire resolution demanded. And this last part of Iraq's initial cover-up is really what seals its fate over the next few years. Because the UN inspectors have focused on material accounting, on accounting for every last piece, every last rocket, every warhead, and by destroying them in secret, by burning them, by exploding them, by dumping them, the chemicals in the ground, it will never be possible to verify in quantity what Iraq once had. So this in many ways is sort of the original sin in this saga, where even as Iraq begins to admit what it has done, what it has destroyed, it will never be possible to fully come clean. When Iraqi officials began to reveal that they had destroyed these weapons in secret in 1992 onwards, they had to explain why they had done this. It seemed like such a self-defeating thing to do. And their explanation was that they were concerned that if they, after all this, came clean about destroying even more weapons, including weapons other countries didn't know that they had, they thought that they would be attacked and that the regime's survival would be in danger. So make of what you will of that explanation, but that was what several different Iraqi officials said independent of each other, and I think it reinforces this disclosure dilemma that was driven by this this cover-up in 1991 and continues to affect Iraqi deliberations about how much to come clean about in years to come. So this is an image of one of the key facilities in the Iraqi biological weapons programs. And its importance was given away to the UN inspectors by this large portrait and also the large walls surrounding it. So those were two clues that caught their attention immediately. So as I mentioned, biological weapons were weapons that Iraq had tried to keep a secret. They had tried to keep these weapons a secret in part because they were closely tied to their security services, and this was a red line for the Iraqi authorities. They did not want to implicate the security services in any of their declarations. That meant that they couldn't give a convincing account of the unilateral destruction in 1991 either, because they were conducted in large part by the security apparatus. And also these weapons, when they were developed during the 70s and 80s, were tested on political prisoners, which was one of the many grave crimes that senior Iraqi officials were concerned that they would be held to account for. They were frequently, when they were discussing amongst themselves, talking about the Nuremberg trials as examples of what they wanted to avoid. So this was very much something that they were concerned about when the UN inspectors came with more and more evidence of a vibrant biological weapons program. And in early 1995, this came to a head when UN officials had, again, concrete evidence of a biological weapons program that they presented to Iraqi officials. And this led to an extensive debate amongst senior Iraqi officials, such as Hussein Kamel on the one hand and Tariq Aziz on the other hand, about what to do. Tariq Aziz had the view that, well, we've admitted to everything else. Why not just admit this as well? Have the sanctions be lifted and be done with it? Hussein Kamel said, on the contrary, if we admit to this now, we will live with sanctions forever. And his reasoning was that Iraq's disclosures and declarations to the United Nations over the past 4 years have been based on concealing the biological weapons and hiding them amongst the chemical weapons declarations. And so if they now confess to having produced biological weapons, it would lead to a reopening of all the files across all areas, and this would never end, Hussein Khamis said. So the conclusion of this extensive debate was a bureaucratic compromise, in a way, whereby Iraqi officials told UN inspectors that, yes, we had such a program. Yes, we produced biological weapons agents in large, large quantities, but we didn't weaponize them. Of course, this was a ridiculous thing to say. Why would you produce vast amounts of weapons agents and not put it into any weapons? But this bureaucratic compromise was a way to avoid this reopening of the accounting. So it's one of many, many examples of how Iraq's concern about the accounting part of this verification came in the way of coming across as credible. Because many of these bureaucratic compromises that came along the way when they were crafting their declarations to the UN inspectors were designed to avoid these kind of entanglement effects. So overall, when Iraq tried to come clean, it often undermined itself in the process. And I think that is one of the key dynamics that I believe is linked to this disclosure dilemma that Iraq was facing throughout this period. After this disclosure, this admission in July 1995 of Iraq having a biological weapons program and producing biological weapons agents, things were looking pretty good for Iraq. There was talk of sanctions relief and even movement towards lifting sanctions in the Security Council. But then Hussein Kamel, this son-in-law from hell, defects because he had been fighting with Saddam's brothers and various other regime members about corruption and things of that nature, which made him very unpopular. So he defects to Jordan, taking with him some of the hidden documents from the WMD programs, and the Iraqi officials essentially panic because they don't know what he will disclose in Jordan. So what they do is to hand over everything that they have hidden in terms of documents from the programs dating back decades in an effort to come clean. But even this effort backfires for the Iraqi officials because it is only cited as evidence by skeptical Security Council members to say that, look, they're all always hiding something, even now. So as Iraq was trying to come clean, their efforts to do so essentially backfired. Nonetheless, the Iraqis somehow continue to try and scale up their cooperation and convince the inspectors there's nothing left over the next couple of years, but nothing results of it. Eventually, the Iraqis tire of this and decide to get rid of the inspectors. As senior Iraqi officials put it at the time, you can have sanctions with inspections or sanctions without inspections. You can choose which one you would like. And after a series of confrontations in 97 and 98, the UN inspectors leave Iraq just before a military campaign, and they don't come back from late 1998 onwards. So when the inspectors leave, access on the ground is lost, and other countries don't have an eye on the ground as they had for the past 7 years. And there are growing concerns about what Iraq is doing now that the inspectors have left Iraq and can no longer monitor their programs and their capabilities. But it turns out that nothing much happened. If anything, the records that exist from Iraqi sources show that some enterprising Iraqi scientists pitch WMD programs but are told not to proceed because that would violate UN resolutions and risk punishment, etc. So they're left in this situation where they've stopped cooperating because there is no way forward, no way to get sanctions lifted, and they're in this situation where they're struggling to control their own scientists and their own bureaucrats, And there are several documents where even Saddam and other senior officials keep asking, we don't have any active programs, right? So all of these questions can be interpreted as, oh, they're interested. Or they could be interpreted as, they really have a problem because they can't oversee the scientists. And I very much think it is that they couldn't oversee and control their scientists, but that they certainly tried as best they could, and that they, the rationale and reasons that they gave to those pitching these biological weapons programs, for example, in the early 2000s, was that you can't because it violates UN resolutions. In 2002, attention turns again to Iraq and its WMD programs. And this is a time when this cheater's dilemma becomes a much sharper dilemma, because the UN passes a resolution, Resolution 1441, in November 2002, where Iraq is found in non-compliance and now once again has to turn over a declaration of not only its past programs, but also everything that it has done since 1998 in a matter of a few weeks. Once that has been submitted, there will be a renewed round of UN inspections conducted by these two, maybe familiar to many of you, Mohammed El-Baradei, who was then the director of the IAEA, and Hans Blix, former director of the IAEA, and then the director of the UN inspectors charged with all of the WMD areas going back into Iraq. So one of the many puzzles about Iraq's behavior during this period, 2002-2003, is, well, why weren't they more proactive in demonstrating that they didn't have these weapons, that they didn't have these capabilities? And one of the interesting pieces of information from the sources that I've accessed is that, in fact, in early 2002, the Iraqi regime was considering such a proactive measure to actually publish their declarations from their past WMD programs in newspapers as a response to some of these emerging allegations from the US and the UK that they had resumed their weapons programs. And so, going through all this correspondence between Iraqi scientists, intelligence agencies, and various officials, you can see all the reasons why they couldn't come clean about this. And those reasons are in themselves very interesting. One of the main themes in all these weapons areas was that we can't provide this information because it violates our obligations under various non-proliferation treaties. So they want to be good citizens. Also, they can't publish this because they would blow the cover of their former suppliers. They can't provide this information because that would reveal operational details of their military capabilities when it came to ballistic missiles. So you can actually go through and see all of the reasons why they can't publish this. Nowhere do you see we can't publish this because it would give away that we have any active programs, because there were no active programs. But again, to those who are curious as to why Iraq was more proactive in rebutting these claims before the inspections resumed, well, good news. There are thousands of pages of sources for you to look at where you can go and see exactly that. And in my mind, the reasons overall point to two main themes. One is, again, that disclosing this information has all kinds of blowback effects with your former suppliers, with being a good citizen of these WMD non-proliferation treaties. And also there's an element of security when it comes to the ballistic missiles only, but that this is not a core theme in the rationales given. So I think it does tell us something about the logic at that time. But Iraq had to compile these accounts, as I said, of their past programs. So they set out to do that and compile declarations of thousands of pages where they essentially tried to account for everything and tried to prove a negative, that there were no new programs. So, as you can imagine, they were caught between a rock and a hard place. They were found in non-compliance. They were trying to fight that judgment, but how do you fight that judgment? How do you prove a negative? On the other hand, they were very concerned with giving any information that could be interpreted as potentially a violation. Now, with many of these programs, WMD programs, you have a dual use problem where the same activity can be used for civilian purposes or military purposes. So you can see certain places in these 2002 declarations where the Iraqis are removing information, historical information that they had previously declared, because they were so concerned to do anything that would justify those who wanted to go for an invasion. So, predictably perhaps, they are then accused of not coming fully clean, of not being proactive, and not doing enough to convince others that they don't have these weapons or capabilities. But frankly, I think it is difficult to see precisely what else they could have done, apart from being perhaps less cautious when it came to this sort of gray zone information. Inspectors arrive in late 2002, and orders go out to Iraqi officials to, at the top there, as you may see, to just allow the inspectors to go in, even if they don't have Iraqi minders with them. So this was increasing, ultimately, the access compared to what had been the case previously after some initial hiccups. And then below, perhaps you can see that they're also instructed to not mention the term nerve gas in any communication whatsoever. So this is an example, and there are many others, of ways in which Iraqi officials try to ensure that there will be no traces of any language, equipment, or anything on the site that could be cited as a violation. They didn't have nerve gas. They just didn't want their officials or guards to talk about nerve gas in any way. And for those who recall the Powell presentation in the Security Council, I'm sure you can imagine why. So these measures were done by Iraqi officials with the goal of avoiding any kind of trouble. Ultimately, they were interpreted as aggressive attempts by the UN inspectors to sanitize the sites and maybe hide evidence. So again, it backfired. This effort to ensure no trouble actually backfired. This is Hossam Amin, who was the director of the Iraqi Monitoring Directorate. He was in the unhappy position of coordinating Iraq's response to the inspectors, and he was one who spent hours and hours pleading with his staff to just do what they were told and increase their cooperation in early 2003, which some of them did and some of them did not. Maybe you also recall some of the allegations that were made by the US and the UK, including aluminium tubes, uranium imports, magnets, and various other items. Well, I've accessed through my Iraqi friends, perhaps sources, some of their own internal investigations that they started in early 2003. Initially, they didn't want to respond to these claims because they found them ridiculous and outlandish and plainly based on falsified documents. But when the International Atomic Energy Agency began to raise these points with Iraq in early 2003, they felt compelled to respond. So they conducted all these inspections, investigations themselves, the Iraqis, to find out what had happened, and rebutted each and every single one. To the Iraqis' great frustration, however, the International Atomic Energy Agency didn't report that for weeks and weeks and weeks. And when they eventually did, it was effectively too late. So again, to the accusation that the Iraqis were not proactive, I think you have to take into consideration that they did probably as much as they possibly could at the time, but that there were delays in the processing in the UN agencies that also created this impression that they were doing too little, too late, as Hans Blix put it. And this is another example for those who want to indulge in the original Arabic. Amr al-Saadi was in charge of giving he was a senior official involved in overseeing the Iraqi WMD programs and then later on in dealing with the UN inspections. And he became sort of the public face of Iraq's effort to prove its case, or at least make its case in public, in the spring of 2003. In a series of efforts to make suggestions of how to resolve the remaining questions about Iraq's WMD and the disarmament back in 1991. And there were a number of suggestions that he and his colleagues made that were feasible. According to Hans Blix, they would have been feasible in a matter of months, maybe weeks. So these questions could have been resolved, perhaps not completely, because that's not technically possible, but substantively they could have been. But Saadi said in one of his last press conferences that we're not trying to escape a war here. War is coming. We're doing what we can to not make the case for war, at least, by making all these suggestions. And I think that this is ultimately what the Iraqi officials thought they could achieve with their efforts in February and March 2003. So what's left of all of this? What is the judgment of Iraq's behavior, and what, if anything, does all this new evidence suggest in terms of how we can rethink or think differently about Iraq's behavior? This is an example of one of the CIA's own retrospective assessments after, of course, the non-finding of WMD, where Iraq's own behavior is cited as a cause of misperception. And Iraq's behavior is puzzling because it doesn't make sense that they would secretly destroy weapons, that they would hide documents when they've handed over their capabilities and destroy their weapons. But I think that the fundamental dilemma that they faced, that I've called the teacher's dilemma, does go some way to explaining some of the more puzzling aspects of Iraq's behavior, and specifically this hiding of their the history of their programs and their documents and supporting documents, these bureaucratic compromises that I've talked about, as opposed to just coming clean in the first instance. So the logic behind Iraq's behavior continues to be debated, as it should be, and I do think that new sources give us much more fine-grained evidence to judge different arguments and different theories that are brought to bear on Iraq's behavior. And in my mind, there is certainly a lot in the Iraqi correspondence pointing to this concern about being asked to hand over these self-incriminating pieces of evidence, and how that kept blowing up in their faces, and that for this reason they wanted to avoid these kind of entanglement effects in the accounting of their WMD disarmament. Other parts of their behavior is not really puzzling. It's not puzzling that they would be wary of handing over information about their security services, for example, or Saddam's residences. So that's much less puzzling. But still, I think that there is plenty of evidence to engage with for having a better sense of some of the puzzles surrounding Iraq's behavior during those fateful years. I should stop here, but thanks very much.
So it is a slightly awkward tradition that I have to ask you several questions.
Go for it.
Beforehand to kick us off, and then we'll go to the audience. So thank you. Thank you so much. I've heard versions of this paper develop over the last several years, and would really, really recommend that everybody, if this is an interesting topic to you, go and find the paper version that came out in International Security, I think last year or maybe last year, on the Cheetah's Dilemma, because it's a really wonderful read. So I've read that, and I've read the parts of the broader manuscript. So for the benefit of the audience, some bits that didn't come up in the talk that I wanted just to probe you on, just to begin with some clarifying questions.
Yep.
Can you provide a description of Iraq's nuclear and biological programs at their peak prior to 1991? I know you said that it's difficult to kind of quantify it, but can you just describe it and give us a sense of what this involved? Can you also, this is maybe a provocation, I'm deeply conscious of the enormous human costs of the sanctions program. Can we though say, putting that aside, if we can suffer that, can we say that actually the sanctions program and the inspections worked? Were they successful? Third, I want to push you on the Cheetah's Dilemma, because it seems to me, you know, the way this is set up, you're talking about the puzzles are rooted in the kind of logics and behavior of the Iraqi regime. And I want to hear the other side of that, which is the logics and reasoning of the US, because this seems to be US-led. Mm-hmm. In a lot of the key kind of turning points of the narrative, when Iraq does come clean, it's often met with skepticism. And I wonder whether, I think this is, maybe you can speak to this, whether this skepticism is actually motivated reasoning, where the reception of this information is deliberately being miscast, or whether there are actually other interests at stake in which the outcome would have been inevitable anyway, and why this might be specific to this cheetah's dilemma as it applies to Iraq, the US, and how Iraq sits in the broader constellation of regional politics and some of the other interests that the US may have had as it applied to Iraq. And finally, and I think you get a flavor of this, how do Iraq regime elites respond to 9/11 and the NATO invasion of Afghanistan, and how does that pattern some of its kind of compliance responses? Thanks.
Thank you very much for a few substantive and great questions. So starting with the state of Iraq's W&D programs, circa 1990-91, the chemical weapons program was, I suppose, thriving. It had really delivered during the Iran-Iraq war with horrific consequences, and was in a state where they could deliver on demand, so to speak. They didn't have to store the weapons, they could produce them and use them very, very quickly. So that had become a very well-honed machine and included fairly rudimentary but also quite advanced weapons capabilities. Iraq's biological weapons program was struggling because they were under great pressure to deliver weapons, and delivered some weapons, but those weapons could only kill you if they hit you on your head, essentially, because producing biological weapons is, from an engineering point of view, very, very complex to get the right particles. You don't want to kill the poison upon landing and so on, upon impact and so on. So they were making efforts, but largely failing to produce very powerful weapons. Iraq's nuclear weapons program was, as I indicated, on the verge of a major breakthrough in 1990-91, and Saddam's nuclear scientists were really puzzled as to why he invaded Kuwait at what was such a fateful time for their nuclear weapons program. And according to both some national assessments and the IAEA's assessments, within a few years, Iraq would likely have had nuclear weapons. They were preparing to test explosions and so on. So it's a varied picture. But they were certainly serious in all their efforts to develop these weapons, and in the case of the chemical weapons, to use them. And I think that the same ambition applied to the biological weapons program, but less successfully. So in terms of the sanctions and inspections package, I think in a way, again, agreeing with you, setting aside the enormous humanitarian costs of the sanctions, they certainly had an impact in shaping the Iraqi regime's choices and their behavior. I've been surprised, looking at the records, how long the Iraqis kept hoping that by complying just a little more, the sanctions might be eased or lifted. And the final blow came in 1997 when Madeleine Albright, then foreign minister of the US, said that it doesn't matter what the Iraqis do, we will not lift sanctions regardless. So it really took up until then for them to stop trying, which I think is quite astounding in a way. But once that clarification came, of course, the incentive disappeared. But I would say that the sanctions and inspections as a whole was very effective. And the inspections really were far more effective than anyone had imagined. There had not been ever an effort by the UN itself to disarm or oversee disarmament of these weapons in any country before. And since, frankly, you haven't really seen it because of the way the processes in Syria and elsewhere were not really conducted in the same manner. But this was a laboratory in a way. Iraq became a laboratory for the various regimes to prevent chemical weapons that emerged during the 1990s. So surprisingly effective, I think one could say. The logics and reasoning of the US, great question. There is, as I indicated in some of the documents that I showed, very early on an impression set in of Iraq's motives and Iraq's modus operandi. And that held firm across different US administrations. So the motivated reasoning would perhaps vary to some extent between those administrations, but the fundamental view of Iraq's MO persisted. So yes, they were surprised and shocked by these early discoveries of Iraqi cheating and cover-ups, and were more and more reluctant to give them the benefit of the doubt. And of course, there was an element of not wanting to take the risk by giving Iraq the benefit of the doubt, lifting sanctions, and then possibly seeing Iraq resume its capabilities. But it does seem to me that this bias or this belief set in very, very early on. And it's one that Bob Jervis described as a surprising lack of curiosity when the U.S., in this instance, intelligence community looked at Iraq's behavior and immediately jumped to the conclusion that they're hiding this to preserve capabilities and discounting that they are hiding embarrassing facts about their own past behavior or even incriminating information about their own past behavior. How did Iraqi officials respond to 9/11? Well, some wanted to provide a message to the U.S., a message of support. Saddam, as I recall, was not interested in doing that. And in some ways, certainly, there is evidence suggesting that Saddam Hussein thought that the U.S. would be so preoccupied in Afghanistan that a war in Iraq would be, or an invasion would be, less likely. That, of course, was wrong. Other senior Iraqi officials took the opposite view and thought, we are likely next. And when these accusations started coming in 2002, they became increasingly concerned that war could be on the horizon.
Great, thank you so much. On that note, can we thank our speaker for today's great talk?